From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When she spoke last week at a human trafficking forum, Elizabeth Smart did not intend to start a debate about abstinence-only education, or really even about the way her church or any church teaches about sexual purity. But it seems clear one of the lessons she received from teachers and church leaders when she was young may have left her with a mixed message or at least a distorted impression. Today in the program, we're discussing the language we use to teach young women about sex. Often the practical questions get mixed in with the moral ones. So we're hoping to hear from you today. What are young women hearing from leaders and teachers? How do you convey the importance of morality and yet preserve self-worth? We're hoping to hear from you today, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We should make it clear here from the outset that when she spoke at a forum on human trafficking at Johns Hopkins University last week, Elizabeth Smart did not intend it as an attack on abstinence-only education, nor did it really seem like a critique of the way her church, the LDS Church, teaches about sexual morality. But what she did say was that whatever the intention of her school or her church, she had come away with a distorted impression of her own self-worth. Smart, you'll remember, was kidnapped from her bedroom in Salt Lake City when she was just 14. She was freed some 9 months later, and she's frustrated and really offended by the question she often gets, "Why didn't you just run away or scream out when the opportunity presented itself?" As if that would have been so easy. She pointed out in the speech that, first of all, she was afraid, petrified, in fact, and who could question that, especially with her remarkable composure and candor?
I remember he brought me far back up into the mountains behind my house, where I was brought inside a tent, forced to change out of my pajamas into long robes just like the ones he had on. And then he came in and told me that I was now his wife and that God had commanded him to do this to me. He then turned on me and raped me on the floor of the tent. And I'll never forget how I felt lying there on the ground. I felt like my soul had been crushed. I felt like I wasn't even human anymore. How could anybody love me or want me or care about me? I felt like life had no more meaning to it. And that was only the beginning of my 9 months of captivity.
But it was this part of her speech that has gotten a lot of attention lately and has raised questions about the language we're using to talk about sex to young people.
But back to my question is, why didn't you run, or why didn't you scream? I think it goes even beyond fear. For so many children, especially in sex trafficking, it's feelings of self-worth. It's feeling like, who would ever want me now? I'm worthless. That is what it was for me when I was the first time I was raped. I was raised in a very religious household, one that taught that sex was something special that only happened between a husband and a wife who loved each other. And that's what I'd been raised. That's what I had always been determined to follow, that when I got married, then and only then would I engage in sex. And so for that first rape, I felt crushed. Who could want me now? I felt so dirty and so filthy. I understand so easily, all too well, why someone wouldn't run. Because of that alone. I mean, if you can imagine the most special thing being taken away from you and feeling like that, not that that was your only value in life, but something that devalued you. Can you imagine turning around and going back into society where you're no longer of value, where you're no longer as good as everybody else? I remember in school one time, I had a teacher who was talking about, about abstinence. And she said, imagine you're a stick of gum. And when you engage in sex, that's like getting chewed. And then if you do that lots of times, you're going to become an old piece of gum. And who's going to want you after that? Well, that's terrible, but nobody should ever say that. But for me, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm that chewed up piece of gum. Nobody re-chews a piece of gum. You throw it away. And that's how easily it is to feel like you no longer have worth, you no longer have value. Why would it even be worth screaming out? Why would it even make a difference if you are rescued? Your life still has no value.
Again, it's important to point out Elizabeth Smart was not attacking abstinence-only education. But she did say the best thing to do for young people is to educate them as young as possible about sex. Not the mechanics necessarily, but the choices and the skills and the language that conveys a young woman's life has value, no matter what. So today in the program, we're talking about the questions raised by Elizabeth Smart, and we're hoping to hear from you. What did you make of what she said and what she meant? What are young women hearing from leaders and from teachers? How do you convey the importance of morality or chastity and yet preserve the idea of self-worth? 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Gail Ruzicka. She's president of the Utah Eagle Forum. Last year, they supported legislation on abstinence-only education. It was eventually vetoed by Governor Gary Herbert. She's joining us today by phone. And Gail Ruzicka, welcome back. Thanks for being with us. I want to begin with something that I know has concerned you. And it's not what Elizabeth said, but the way you believe what she said is being spun. What do you make about the way people are reacting to what Elizabeth Smart said?
Well, you know, whenever anything like this happens, you always have somebody who jumps on board with their own interpretations of what she said. And, of course, there are those out there like Think Progress who have a very liberal agenda, who've taken what she said and turned it into an slams against religion, slams against teaching morality and virtue, none of which she did. Everybody knows that Elizabeth's a very, very pure and virtuous woman, and that she grew up being taught those things, that she's supportive of those things, that she loves her church. She served a mission for the church. She married in the temple. She loves her parents. She gives her parents credit for her survival through all of this. And yet some of those publications out there have twisted all that to say that it was the teachings of her parents and the teachings of her church that she was attacking in her statements. Well, everybody listening knows that that's absolutely not what happened. In fact, the very thing that she example that she used that received all the criticism, she learned at school. She didn't learn that at church, and she didn't learn that at home. She did point out that she learned in her home and in her church about purity. I'm sure Elizabeth's going to teach her own children about purity because that's what she believes, because that's what's taught in her culture, and she praises both her parents and her church all the time. I happen to be friends with the parents and know exactly the relationship that they have with Elizabeth and how extremely close they are and how much they all adore each other. And Elizabeth said many times over and over through those 9 months, she survived by knowing that her parents loved her and that they were there for her, that they would always be there, and that she survived by knowing that that her Heavenly Father loved her. And she's been taught all her life that she's a child of God. I don't know anything better that you could ever teach children. If you believe in God, if you believe in the deity of God, then to think that to be taught and know, and she does know, that he, in fact, is her father and that she is a child of God, a better thing could a child ever know in their lives, and to get them through the worst horrible things that ever happened to them, because that in itself just says they have value. If you're a child of God, you always, always will know you have value.
So, okay, let's go with your premise then, because I think it's been pointed out before, she wasn't condemning abstinence-only education. She wasn't saying it was okay to experiment with safe sex. So let's go with that idea. It does seem she was saying that people with good intentions might have been muddling the lesson a bit, and she certainly got the impression that her self-worth was wrong. Do you agree with that part of it, that she got a mixed message?
Yeah, I think anybody, I don't care in what context they're doing it, I can't even believe that this kind of teaching would be going on in the school, but anybody who would compare sexual activity to, you know, you being a piece of gum and if you've had sex, you know, that gum has been chewed, and once it's been chewed several times, you know, it's no longer a decent piece of gum. What an outrageous, unbelievable thing to have taught children. And I think any parent who had a child in that classroom that found out about it, and sad to say, you know, those kinds of things happen in a classroom often. Parents don't find out, especially in a situation with sex education classes, because children just do not come home and share what they've been taught in a sex education class.
But let me ask you
many examples of that. So more than likely, Elizabeth's parents didn't even know she was taught that.
Sure.
Maybe they did, but if they did, I'm sure they straightened it out. But what a terrible, terrible thing to teach a child. It just makes me furious. I mean, that somebody would be that callous to teach a child that if you ever do have sex, then you suddenly become worthless. That's outrageous.
But let me ask you.
We should teach them just the opposite.
Right.
Teach them just the opposite. You've made a mistake. Let's work on that together. You know, you put your mistakes behind you. You move forward because you are an important person and you always have value.
But Gail Ruzicki, have you not heard of, because we've heard a lot of these object lessons coming, not in fact from school, but from church teachers, well-intentioned, who've used object lessons like chewing gum, like wilted roses, like licked cupcakes, like tarnished pennies, like soiled wedding dresses, like used cars, to make a point about sexual purity. Are you saying you've never heard that in LDS
the examples that you just used are not ones that I've ever heard, but I have to tell you, if I ever had a child with a teacher say it's something like that, I would be at that teacher's house. If it was at the church, I would be to the bishop, talking to the bishop about it. In this case, Elizabeth said it was in the school. I would be at the school talking to the teacher, talking to the principal. I think that's outrageous. And I, you know, there's not any place that you'll find in any manual from the LDS church where they use or suggest those examples at all.
But that's not the question. The question isn't whether or not the church is saying use these or the curriculum is saying use these. The question is whether or not, in fact, those object lessons are being used.
Well, I have to tell you that from my own personal experience, we have, you know, in our family, we have not experienced that. I'm sure if people are out there have it talking about those things, that they are out there. And that's just wrong. It's absolutely wrong. So, yes, they're probably out there somewhere, whether, you know, I could say churches, whether it's in the churches, in the schools, or who knows? I don't know. Maybe people can go online and find that kind of stuff. But it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. That's the opposite message that you should ever, ever be teaching children about relationships, about premarital sex. I mean, if you teach them that about premarital sex, then how do they ever go into the marital relationship with any feeling of something that is sacred being sacred? You don't talk about sacred things that way.
Let me ask you, I wanted to get your take on what it was you think Elizabeth Smart seemed to be saying about abstinence-only education or about sex education in general, because she said that the best thing we can do is to educate young people as young as possible, and that it's important, she said, even more important than math and science, to talk about sex. Again, not the mechanics necessarily, but the choices, the skills, and this idea of knowing that you have value, that should be taught younger than it's being taught right now, that kids can handle these conversations about sex, appropriate conversations about sex at young ages. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's a very personal thing for individual families and individual children because of what children are exposed to today in today's world. There was a time when people kind of put ages on things, but you know, you can't do that anymore. That's why only parents can make that decision for each individual child in their home because they know the child. They know what's going on in the world. They know what children are being exposed to. And yes, I think it's a matter of not, like you said, not teaching the children the details and the how-tos, but teaching children, you know, about their own bodies and about, the importance of not letting somebody violate them. And that's really what she was talking about. She was talking about those that are being violated. And you know, our abstinence-only bill that we had that tragically was vetoed by the governor because he didn't find out, nor did the people, so many of the people protesting it, what that law would really mean and what the lessons would be taught. You know, 66 legislators voted for it because they took the time to find out. That's exactly what it was teaching. It was teaching them the value of who they are I mean, it wasn't abstinence only doesn't mean you quit teaching sex. You don't have sex education. They still have sex education. In fact, we have four districts right now that teach abstinence only. And when they look at the STD numbers coming out of those districts, they're much lower for those districts because they teach the children the skills on how to say no. They teach children why to say no. They teach children about their own value, that they are good people, important people, and that we trust them, that we actually know that if they want to say no, they can and will say no. It's, you know, somehow we treat children like they're animals and say, well, we've got to teach them all of the details because, yeah, it's nice if they say no, but we know better. I mean, I had so many people tell me that, you know, we know better. We know children are not going to say no. Well, that's ridiculous. We tell them to say no to drugs. We don't say, well, we know they won't say no, so we can't teach them the truth about drugs. We need to teach them the truth, and we need to teach them the value of abstinence and the value of waiting for marriage in their life and what that will ultimately mean for them. But we need to do it in a way that it lets them know that sexual relationships within the marriage is sacred, and that those who are already out there participating in that aren't married yet, that they can still say no. They can still say, you know what, I'm done with that, just like with drugs. Just because they use drugs doesn't mean that they've lost their value. It just means you learn how to say no. And that's the same way with premarital sex. And so, like I say, anybody who teaches lessons that takes away a person's value, I mean, that would be the opposite. That would be the opposite of what we... as we put forth this bill of what was to be taught. If a person thinks they have no value, then they'll just continue to be out there having premarital sex. If we teach them, in fact, you do have value, and that, you know, so what if you've already done that in the past? It's the future we're talking about. Right. And that was what this abstinence only was all about, was teaching children how to say no and how to change, if that was the behavior they were involved in, how to change that behavior and work toward those things in their lives that are good, to teach them that the negative sides of premarital sex, anywhere from,
okay,
from
Gail,
the physical to the emotional.
You have made that point. Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. That's Gail Ruzicka, president of the Utah Eagle Forum. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing the language we use to talk about sex to young women. Last week, Elizabeth Smart spoke at a human trafficking forum. She didn't intend to condemn abstinence-only education. We're making that clear. But she did raise some important questions about it and about the messages that come from conservative cultures like this one. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Carl is with us in Park City. Carl, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a point that I think really the deeper issue is teaching, moving away from shame and guilt and maybe kind of speaking more from a level of courage. Kind of there's a book by Dr. David Hawkins. He wrote Power Versus Force, but in there he kind of talks about those different things. And as Elizabeth Smart is speaking, I think it's not necessarily the message, but it's the energy behind that. The shame and the guilt are what really drive people's values down within that, or the self-worth. Or I think moving in a space of courage would be more effective, or at least trying to do that would be a better way of teaching.
Do you get a sense that, I mean, she seems concerned, Elizabeth Smart, that kids are not getting that message in school and not early enough. Do you think that's where she was coming from?
I think so. I think there's an element of that that comes across. It's kind of there's a subtle difference, but I think it's very, it is a difference. And it's kind of the point where people will say, hey, it's kind of like as if a kid said to mom and dad says to the kid, hey, look, you know what, if you do this, this, and this, then you'll be my kid, then you're worthy, then you're acceptable. And the reality is, look, you can do whatever you want to do, and you're still going to be my kid, regardless. And I think that's, you know, stuff happens, but the energies of shame and guilt, they draw people down versus an element of truth and courage and saying, hey, honestly, yeah, that's what happened. but let's be courageous and say, you know what, let's move from not dwelling in the shame and the guilt area of it, or focusing on that you're not acceptable, but you're okay, and that happened, and let's move to a better place.
Carl, glad you called. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Karen is with us in Salt Lake. Karen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on Gail's comments about her own personal experience in her life and with her family, was that she hadn't heard of these stories about examples of chewed gum and so forth. And I just wanted to say that I was raised in an LDS family and an LDS community. And I can tell you that throughout my life, all of the information I got about sex being bad and wrong was through being involved in my church. And absolutely did I hear those stories and examples being taught to me in primary, in young women's, in seminary, and throughout the course of my relationship with the Mormon church. I also want to say that I always felt like it was always put on the girl that if the boy didn't want her, it was her fault because she had made that mistake. Now, that may not be everybody's experience, but it certainly was mine, and it certainly was in the community that I was raised in. So I just want to speak for those that had a different experience.
Glad you called. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
801-585-WEST, again, the number two, join the conversation. Joining us now is Joanna Brooks, who blogs about Mormonism at the online magazine ReligionDispatches.org. She's also the author of the memoir, The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. She's a professor of English and comparative literature at San Diego State University. She's joining us today from her office there. And Joanna Brooks, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Doug, thanks for having me.
So you wrote in a post this week that Elizabeth Smart's remarks kind of set off this fierce debate among LDS people in particular. You know, questions like, is this what we really believe? Is this what we really teach? We'll get to that, but how did you react to the way people are responding to Elizabeth Smart?
Well, you know, when I heard Elizabeth Smart's remarks at Johns Hopkins University last week for the first time, and she mentioned the chewed up piece of gum.
Yeah.
I had a visceral reaction. I mean, when I was a teenager in a regular Mormon ward in Southern California, I had object lessons about sexual morality. It wasn't gum. In my case, it was the rose passed around the circle and fingered until it was browned and wilted. And so immediately there was a gut check of recognition. And I know many, many other women who experienced the same. And it has sparked her telling of that story, her connecting it to her inability to muster agency, to get out, because her feelings of worthlessness during her captivity has sparked this very difficult conversation among LDS people. It's difficult to hear Elizabeth Smart say, I felt that my most special thing was taken from me. It's difficult to teach teenagers sexuality, and it's difficult, you know, working within a faith tradition where even leaders we revere as prophets have a mixed record of the comments of the way they've taught purity in the past.
So what do you think, what do you make of those object lessons? I mean, you know, Elizabeth isn't that old, so apparently she's been getting them not so long ago, so they're not just remnants of the past, it seems. But what's the
point?
Go ahead.
And there's been some confusion about where she actually heard it, and I listened very closely to the tape again last night, and she was in junior high school, and the teacher was female, and so I'm suspecting that, you know, she had a human sexuality teacher at her junior high school who happened to be LDS, and who, faced with a classroom of young teenagers talking about a really sensitive and difficult subject, fell back on something she knew very well, an object lesson from her own childhood. I mean, nowhere in, I read last night the Utah State curriculum on human sexuality for junior high schoolers, you know, nowhere in the Utah State curriculum and nowhere in current LDS church manuals are these object lessons used, but, you know, the way we teach our children sexual morality and Mormonism, the church employs a worldwide legion of unpaid, untrained volunteers to face classrooms full of teenagers, you know, and people fall back on what they know best. And oftentimes it's a recycling of morality lessons, these object lessons that were used in our own youth.
So what is
it? Clearly, there's a persistence at the level of folk doctrine.
Okay, folk, which I want to get to actually, because you talk. It seems like it gets into the bloodstream and it takes a long time to sort of make its way out. These kinds of stories, and not just related to this particular question of chastity, question of, you know, race, those kinds of things seems to persist, which we'll get back to. But I am interested in exactly what it is this object lesson is supposed to convey anyway, because it's making, it's making the connection between rape and chastity or something, or this idea of virtue being this thing that if you lose,
right,
has these incredible consequences.
Well, and in this is not particular to Mormonism. This is,
of course,
a sexist construction of sexuality that has, that has plagued women for centuries now. It didn't start with Mormonism. It's just traditional misogyny, this idea that your chastity is an object that can be forcibly taken or given away, that it's a thing. Even Mormon theology, which really has a more positive view of embodiment, the best of Mormon theology would suggest that this is a profound power that must be handled with care and responsibility and reverence. But, this message that chastity is a thing, an object that can be owned or taken, that's the root of the problem.
There's a blogger, Christine Haglund, that you've referenced, others have noticed too. And she talks about in a post she made this story in the Mormon scripture, the Book of Mormon, in Moroni in particular, where one group of people take these prisoners of these women and deprive them, according to the scripture, of that which was most dear and precious above all things, which is chastity and virtue. And what Christine is saying is, hey, church leaders, just go in and ditch that thing. Like, we don't need that anymore, because that's problematic. Talk a little bit about that part.
Right, and Christine Haglund is a really important voice in the Mormon blogosphere. She's editor of Dialogue, which is a Mormon studies journal. And, Christine posted a very impassioned call for a revision to Church Materials for Young Women, the Personal Progress books, which young girls use as sort of goal-setting guide their progress through curriculum for teenagers in the LDS Church. And Christine said, look, there's still this scripture being used to teach young women that they need to stay, sexually pure. And it's a scripture that describes chastity as something that can be forcibly taken. Again, this construction of one's sexuality as an object.
Yeah.
And it references the Book of Mormon, which actually is a scene, this war scene when captives are raped. And she says, this is totally inappropriate. What I'm hearing Christine say and other Mormon women bloggers say is that there needs to be a shift from talking about sexuality as a matter of purity to one of responsibility, where young women are not saddled with this idea that their job is to keep themselves pure for a future spouse, as has been taught in manuals, not the most recent iteration of young women's curriculum, but prior to that, that chastity is not a thing that can be taken by an abuser or a rapist, but that sexuality is instead a responsibility that you, as part of your spiritual development, need to learn to use reverently. I'm hearing that call from Mormon feminist bloggers, and it's happening in the context of this discussion this week.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Marjorie is with us in Eagle Mountain, Utah. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment was pertaining to Elizabeth Smart's comment on feeling like she was used to a piece of chewing gum. And I just feel like it needs to open up a broader conversation on the feeling that comes from being raped or sexually abused or sexually assaulted, whether it's through a kidnapping that she experienced or through a date rape or a family member, that because of those actions, that's a natural consequence, or I guess that feeling of being used and being worthless comes with that violent act or that... Does that make sense?
Of course, of course.
In fact,
I got it. And I
think it's a very difficult conversation to open up to your, children and to your young daughters, because you want, when you're teaching sexuality, you want it to be a positive and a beautiful thing. But then to have to open up a conversation to how do you protect yourself? And it's important to say, how do you say no? Because, you know, the statistics are very, very bad on, you know, what women potentially can experience. You know, 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 will experience a sexual assault, or, you know, 1 in 3 women have or know someone that has been raped.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this. In fact, let me get another guest involved to add to the conversation. Jeanette Goetz-Smith is joining us, a licensed marriage and family therapist in Jacksonville Beach, Florida, actually. An active member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we should say. She regularly writes for the online LDS magazine Meridian and is the author of the book Unsteady Dating, What Every Parent Absolutely Must Know About Teenage Romance. She's joining us from her office in Florida. And Jeanette Goetz-Smith, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Why don't you respond, if you would, to what we were hearing from Marjorie, this idea of that it's not just about chastity education, but in some ways, I guess, it's a kind of about a power equation. This is another thing that young women need to understand.
Right. There's a big difference between abuse and consensual sex. And Elizabeth, of course, was the victim of abuse. When you talk about youth that are consensual, that it's a totally different picture. And when you have a power differential like you did with Elizabeth Smart, she's helpless. She can't say no. Her life is in danger. And a lot of times abuse victims, it's either their life or their pets or their family members' life, just like the caller from Eagle Mountain was stating. So when you're talking about taking personal responsibility for staying chaste or saying no, you have to look at an adolescent who has the ability that they have enough power in the relationship to say no. And that usually only happens when they're, you know, both of the same age, both of them equally confident. You even have cases of date rape where there's a power differential. And the young woman really shouldn't be accused of unchastity in a situation like that, because she didn't ask for it, and she may have even said no. But because she felt powerless, she ended up being a victim.
So how is it, and Joanna, I want to come back to you, but let me just get Jeanette on this point. So how is it that they're getting, how is it that leaders are going back to these ideas of wilted roses and licked cupcakes? Is it just because they don't have the capacity to really talk about some of these difficult questions?
You know, I think that's probably it. Object lessons are a dangerous thing because they're never really perfectly accurate. And people will interpret object lessons in their own way. They stick in your mind because there's a visual picture. They're vivid, but they don't always depict the message that you're trying to say. So I think the first problem is that we need to be careful about how we use object lessons.
There, Joanna Brooks, you've written about this. That here's what it says in a church pamphlet. This is called For the Strength of Youth. It says, victims of rape, incest, or other sexual abuse are not guilty of sin. If you have been a victim of any of these crimes, know that you are innocent and that God loves you. I mean, that's a pretty compassionate statement, and this is the official one. How is it that maybe the message is getting through, but where's the disconnect there between that and someone passing around a licked cupcake?
Well, Mormonism
is changing, and we see this good messaging, this revision, and this effort to help victims know it's not their fault. We see that coming very clearly from the top down, and yet the anecdotes keep coming from women who've been called to repent after sexual abuse, you know, from women whose perpetrators stay in the same ward and there's nothing, you know, done to them. And when we see it in Elizabeth Smart's testimony last week, I mean, it's 2002, she's 14 years old. How on earth does a woman coming out of our community with the idea that her, quote, most special thing was lost when she is raped? And we see, you know, part of it dates to comments by high-ranking church leaders as late as the 1970s and early 1980s that do say, you know, it's better to be dead than have your chastity taken from you. That's an old part of the Mormon record. But we also see it, I think, more to the point and more closer to Elizabeth Smart's case, in the contemporary teaching that sexual purity is a thing, and that keeping that thing is tied to your life chances. There's such an emphasis on marriage in Mormon communities theologically, but also practically for conservative, observant young women like Elizabeth Smart, marriage is your ticket to a home, a family, an income, and a future, as well as to heaven itself. So the idea that when you know, lose your chastity, if that's how you're raised to think about it, you then become less attractive to potential marriage partners. You know, all rape victims feel shame and guilt, but it's compounded when religious cultures emphasize chastity as something that can be, as an object that can be taken.
Jeanette Goldsmith, you say this focus, you've seen this focus change, you say, in the church, that there used to be this focus on chastity, but you're seeing a kind of transition now more toward the idea of compassion, forgiveness, not giving up. I mean, you're seeing a kind of a transition within Mormonism?
Yeah, I don't think you'll ever hear a talk about sexual immorality that doesn't have an equal time given to the idea of repentance or becoming clean. I mean, President Monson's famous for his quote about there's no fog so dense, no night so dark, no gale so strong, no mariner so lost, where the lighthouse of the Lord can rescue. You know, he says that a lot. And it's that sentiment that is being taught at least as much as the idea that try, you know, stay morally clean. But if you don't, there's always that caveat in whatever present talk you hear. But if you don't, there's always a way back.
So I want to get to some more calls and take a break here in a moment. But Joanna Brooks, I want to get to, again, this idea of how it is these folk doctrines or these folk ideas, how it is that they persist. Because you talk about how no matter what the manuals say, no matter what the kind of official position may be, you've got a bunch of lay teachers who are, you know, insurance salesmen and, you know, doctors and lawyers.
School teachers. I mean,
school teachers.
High school teachers.
Exactly.
And stay-at-home moms.
Right.
Who trying to figure out how to teach this very sensitive subject.
Yeah.
Right?
So why doesn't the church sort of confront this stuff a little bit more aggressively and say, all right, Cain was not, in fact, cursed black. Let's ditch that, you guys, and stop talking about it in testimony meeting or whatever it is. I mean, how is it that these things keep persisting?
I think it's a very powerful parallel you're drawing there that, you know, long after the lifting of the ban on black ordination, old teachings from church leaders from Brigham Young to Bruce R. McConkie have continued to circulate in LDS communities, rationalizing the ban itself, tying it to Cain or Ham or some very speculative doctrine about, you know, some very speculative Mormon folklore about the war in heaven. And those took decades to flush from the Mormon system. And now studies show that, you know, it's in the single digits of LDS people who actually believe them. I mean, that was assisted by aggressive anti-racism in mainstream American life. You know, we are still working through sexist folk doctrine in Mormon culture. And unfortunately, mainstream and secular culture is not our ally. Women are objectified in the secular media, you know, just as sexuality is objectified when it's taught in LDS context as a thing that can be taken or lost. So, you know, one thing that makes me hopeful is that Mormonism does have a theology that says embodiment is good, sexual powers are important, divine in origin, and need to be used responsibly. I think that's the core message of our theology. We have that on our side, but it's going to be an uphill battle, flushing old sexist folk doctrine, including the idea that it's better to be dead than lose your virtue, including the idea that, you know, sexual virtue can be compared to a cupcake or a rose. Yeah. We're going to have an uphill battle flushing that objectification of women's sexuality from Mormonism because it's not flushed from the mainstream either.
Jeanette Goldsmith, you agree?
Yeah, you know what I think we really need to be careful is that we don't just look at it as the taking of the virtue as the thing that is the tragedy. The tragedy is when someone is raped or molested, it changes their core belief about themselves. It changes their self-esteem. It takes away their agency. They feel helpless. They personally feel like an object because they were used. It's not just their sexuality. It's them as a person that was treated like an object. So if someone says, you know, I would rather my daughter be, you know, dead than raped, it may not be because the virtue's gone, but because it is such a traumatizing thing for a young lady to go through. It takes, I mean, Elizabeth is such a remarkable success story because she has done such a great job of recovering, but it is really difficult to recover from this kind of trauma emotionally. And I think that's why it's such a sad thing when it happens.
But let's take...
And yet it's important to note, it's so quotidian. I mean, Elizabeth is an extreme and very dramatic case, but like one out of three of the people listening to this program right now have been molested or abused. You know, it's so common. It's so quotidian. People do heal, do move on. It's such a part of our landscape. It's something that I'm excited by Elizabeth's foundation and her efforts to teach, you know, from a more informed basis of how to think about abuse.
But let's take molestation and rape out of it for just a minute. What about the young woman in the young women's class? And again, this is not just LDS. We should say that these kinds of conversations are being had in a lot of conservative cultures, the Bible Belt, other places. But let's take out, again, abuse for a moment. What about the young girl who has had sex in junior high school or in high school? How is she supposed to be regarded? Where does that fit in the scheme of things?
Well, once again, I think that the message is not, again, the caller from Eagle Mountain was right on target when he said, don't shame these poor kids, because you're not a bad person. Whatever choice you made is a choice that wasn't in your best interest. It probably isn't going to lead to happiness now or in the long run. So what we want to help these kids recognize is you're a wonderful person and you deserve better than that. You deserve joy in your future. You deserve to have a happy marriage. And this kind of behavior may interfere with the happiness of your marriage. So why don't you make a choice not to do this because it'll make you happier in the long run, because you will feel more peace, not because you're bad, but because you want to have the best advantages in life that you can possibly have.
Joanna, what do you think?
Oh, this is just a very difficult question because, you know, what I see as an observer of Mormon culture and as I'm listening in on these difficult conversations among Mormon people is that we have really, really good intentions about how to teach sexual morality to young people, but the messages young people carry away end up sounding very different than what we hope they'll carry away. We see wonderful revisions happening in LDS curriculum, for example, in new manuals for young men and young women released in January that are parallel for young men and young women, trying not to put a special burden on young women for, you know, maintaining a purity that is to be given to a husband someday. At the same time, we see a resurgence of an aggressive modesty culture in which young women are being taught that they are responsible for putting sexualized thoughts in the heads of their, you know, their Mormon male contemporaries, which is a demeaning construction of Mormon young men, as well as if they can't be in charge of their own sexuality. Yeah. It's a difficult, long process for any faith culture to undertake. And our young people are still carrying away mixed messages.
That's Joanna Brooks. She blogs at the online magazine religiondispatches.org. Her memoir is called The Book of Mormon Girl, Stories from an American Faith. Jeanette Goetz-Smith is with us, a marriage and family therapist and the author of Unsteady Dating, What Every Parent Must Know About Teenage Romance. We'll get to more of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, by the way, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are working through some of the questions that came up in a remarkable speech last week by Elizabeth Smart at a human trafficking forum at Johns Hopkins University. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Stephanie sent this to us. She said, the idea of purity goes to the value of a woman. It's only... is only in what you can get out of her, and that is heavily manipulated with the education of chastity. This is an issue, she says, that's pushing the idea that a woman's only value is in regards to reproduction. Greg says, these sorts of object lessons that we've been talking about are rife within the stakes of Zion and could be stopped quite easily by a declaration from the hierarchy of the LDS Church. Why they haven't made such a proclamation is beyond me, and he writes, borders on abuse. 801-585-WEST, the number two, join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Audrey is with us in Roy, Utah. Audrey, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just going to be brief here. I just think that it seems like the impression or perception about how we handle sexuality happens or grows within us between the ages of birth and eight, and particularly in the LDS Church, if you're so-called accountable by the time you're eight, then, you know, we need to have a positive impression until then, until the age of eight. I'm sorry, I'm not making sense here.
Yeah.
And then after eight, we need to learn the facts, the science, the anatomy, so that by the time we hit puberty, we have an understanding so that we can make our own educated decisions. Because the thing, there's this huge thing that nobody in the American culture talks about, and nobody, you know, it's just made worse by the LDS Church's concern about morality, that there's a bond created with sexuality, whether it's appropriate or not. And that's what causes so many issues, because it's an emotional bond that happens with this physical experience. So again, you know, the impression is created when the kids are so young. So that's when we need to have, you know, the most, when we need to, well, okay, so for instance,
it's when we need to be more candid.
Families, because there's always a baby being born, right? So there's a toddler and then there's a baby. So when they're two, they learn, you know, if we don't exclude them from the experience, they learn because mom's pregnant, she's having a baby, so you can address it as a toddler. When they're four, another kid is born. So, you know, you address it to a four-year-old, and you can just grow them through what's age appropriate for understanding in an appropriate way.
Well, let's get some response from that. And I think, Joanna Brooks, let's say this, and Jeanette Goldsmith, you too on this question. What Audrey is also saying is that this is not just a Mormon thing, that Americans tend to be kind of freaked out about talking about sex with their young people anyway. Does anyone want to respond to Audrey in that sense?
Well, this is the most difficult hour of radio I've ever done. How to talk about, you know, how do you talk about an essential part of the of human capacity in ways that don't objectify it, in ways that are theologically rich, that are responsible? It's tough. It's tough to teach teenagers and children about sexuality. I know that as a parent. We are witnessing in Mormonism a continuing conversation about how to best convey conservative sexual morality values,
right,
without portraying sexuality as an object, without putting too much of a burden on young women, without unwittingly shoring up the objectification of women by objectifying purity. It is difficult.
I think we need to differentiate between two completely different kinds of sex. You've got the sex that's exploitive, and that may or may not be that because of someone's a victim, but it's still exploitive. And then you've got sex that's a gift, sex that's loving, sex that is to bless the other person in your life. And we need to teach our youth that there's two different kinds of sex, and they want to make sure that they always enjoy the sex that's a blessing in their life and never become subject to the sex that's exploitive. We don't teach.
But it's also a fact of, you know, teenage experience and of adult experience, there's also sex that's confusing and sex that's boring and sex that's not fun. It's a very complicated subject, human sexuality. We don't do our young people any favors by portraying sex as a wonderful, marvelous, magical thing that will suddenly happen on your wedding night. There's legions of anecdotal evidence from within Mormon culture of young people who are raised with very strict chastity lessons and come to marriage and really fumble their way through embarrassedly what was supposed to be this magical, life-transforming event. And some of them, you know, never establish healthy sexual connections. Mormon therapists tell this story all the time. I'm sure you've seen it in your own practice. It's hard because sex is many things. It is beautiful. It can be abusive. It also can just be very human and confusing. And that's why a robust theological approach like Mormonism provides. It says this is a part of our human experience, and we're given bodies. Mormon scriptures, men are that they might have joy. How do we produce the most joyful, empowered Mormon young people possible? It's a tough, tough question.
Well, when you look at how our prophets and church leaders are combining the idea of repentance in the very same talks as they're talking about chastity, and they're integral, you also look at when we teach our youth about sex, we teach in the very same conversation, it's wonderful in its context. And you keep those two messages in together, and you continually talk about how wonderful it is. But you also add that caveat in the proper context. In a marriage, it's wonderful. And I don't think it has to be that confusing. I think when it is a gift and when it is done to bring other people, your spouse, joy, I don't think it has to be confusing. And I think we can communicate that to our youth. Just make sure you do it at the right time and place, and it'll happen naturally, and you'll both be pleased.
We've got about a minute left, so let's divvy this up 30 seconds apiece. Joanna and Jeanette, it was a good thing that Elizabeth Smart started this conversation. Jeanette, you first.
Yeah, I do think it's a good thing. I think the most important thing is that not only do we talk to our youth about appropriate sexuality, but we talk to them about inappropriate sexuality. We have to warn these kids as three, 4 years old, as soon as they're able to comprehend it, about good touches and bad touches, and you don't have to let somebody touch you in any way that makes you feel uncomfortable. And those conversations cannot happen too early.
Hard to talk about, Joanna, but you're glad we are, I guess.
Oh, Elizabeth Smart has emerged as this very unlikely but important Mormon pop leader. I'm so glad she spoke out, frankly, as she did last week, about the impact of object lessons on her. I am very hopeful that Mormonism as a culture is well into the process of rooting out sexist folk doctrines, but I think we still have a long ways to go towards developing a fully right message about affirming sexual responsibility. So we're watching the story unfold right now, and thank you for hosting the discussion.
It's Joanna Brooks. She blogs at the online magazine religiondispatches.org. Joanna, thanks. It's good to have you with us, as always.
Thank you, Doug.
And Jeanette Goetz-Smith, marriage and family therapist, the author of the book Unsteady Dating, What Every Parent Must Know About Teenage Romance. Thanks to you as well. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I encourage you to go to our website. You can continue the conversation. We weren't able to get to some stories that I think are powerful and important. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.